Oh, hey, before we start the show, let me just mention that Mythic Bastion Land is written by Chris McDowell with amazing art by Alex Sorensen, and you can find more information about the game at bastionland.com. The Smiling Fox, on the other side, is very much an unofficial fan project, a podcast by fans for fans. And in any case, you shouldn't trust the Smiling Fox. He's kind of a dodgy fella. Welcome to the Smiling Fox, a Mythic Bastionland podcast. I am Horst.
I am Brian.
And hey, I'm William.
And this is a podcast entirely dedicated to the amazing RPG Mythic Bastionland. This is our first episode, Trust the System. Guys, what do you think? Did we choose the name Smiling Fox?
You mean apart from just being a beautiful image to have in the listener's head?
It is a beautiful image. It's also pretty much the first strange creature that jumps out of the page if you crack open the book.
Yeah, and I think one of the striking things about it is it's one of the first things that you encounter that you don't immediately know what to do with. There is a strange fox up a tree that wants to witness a death. I think some people are used to puzzles in games that have maybe an obvious solution. Here's a fox in a tree. You can leave him in the tree if you want to, or you can cause a death to happen in front of him. It's up to you.
I think also the ambiguity of if you mention to your players it's a smiling fox, you don't know if they're going to think it's some sinister creature or if it's like, oh, cute, he's smiling at us, he's happy. It could go both ways.
And yeah, the kind of juxtaposition between the happy, smiling fox, what a cute creature, and their malicious motivation speaks to me personally. And also, listeners, don't trust the smiling fox. What you should trust is the system, which brings us to the question, why did we pick this as our first topic to talk about?
I can speak about trusting the system from the experience of not trusting the system. So, going back to my first time running Mythic Bastion Land, which was 2024, February, it was the full game. The full game was available as a PDF to Kickstarter backers. The art wasn't fully ready yet, but the rules were there and the myths were there. And the first time I ran it, I had in the back of my mind, if nothing exciting happens, I can have a fight with some bandits, which is like the most obvious kind of generic encounter you can have. I did lean into the system. I did roll on Spark tables and interpret those prompts, but my mind was so primed to have bandits appear that the first prompt that I encountered, which is something like protect home or something, I took as being about there are bandits roving around the place. I think I even inserted a village into an empty hex because it seemed like when they arrive in this realm, they should meet some people in a village who give them something to do. I think you could argue that I was not actually running Mythic Bastion Land. I was running another type of game with Mythic Bastion Land rules on top of it. And it worked well. We got to see some combat. Everyone got a little bit comfortable with it. But I know in retrospect, it wasn't needed.
And that's also one of the reasons why we're doing this podcast. For example, on the Discord, we get a lot of questions from people who are trying to mold the game into something that it kind of isn't, or at least it doesn't have to be. When I first read the PDF, I was kind of confused at what it was. And I watched Chris's one shot that he did, and it just everything fell into place. I think trust the system would be good advice for me to give to my former self when I first opened the PDF. And I was just looking at this and I'm like, there's nothing here. Like, how am I supposed to use this to make a fun game?
Let me dig a bit deeper. Where does the anxiety come from? Like you say that you wanted an encounter, but aren't the omens encounters?
I think I personally came to this system. I'd run other things. I had experience with a few different types of games, but the primary influence on me was D&D 5th edition. And I had a shadow hanging over my mind that every session has to have combat. So meeting a smiling fox in a tree, for example, is an encounter because it's a strange thing you have to deal with. But I had in my mind that that fox better jump down at you and have a little sword or something, because that's role-playing games.
So you would say that the expectation is from other games, and coming with that expectation into Mythic Bastionland, you might be confused at first. What do you guys think about drop-in adventures or mini dungeons? Is that completely crazy talk?
I think that running a game can be a nerve-wracking experience, depending on your level of experience and the types of games you've run in the past. And I think that having something pre-prepared that you can use if you need it, I think that's a useful tool. Even if you never present it to the players, but you know that no matter what happens, I can say a messenger has been sent from the ruler and they've said, please come at once, there's a disaster and we need to deal with this. And then you're on rails and you know what you're doing. I think that can be helpful for people, and I wouldn't tell them to not do that. But I think it's good to, as we say, trust the system, have a few omens, let them play out, see how you respond, see how the players respond, and you might be surprised at how natural it feels after giving it a try.
I think also it's almost like a reflex that a lot of people have when they see it, like a hex map. And what you usually do with the hex map is you fill it with hooks and cool stuff to interact with. Whereas if you're used to that, this game is somewhat counterintuitively kind of empty, actually. It's the omens themselves that generate the kind of encounters that you'd otherwise place within the hex map. And I think that is counterintuitive to a lot of people coming from other games or just looking at a map that's kind of empty, you know?
I understand the instinct, and I love the idea that Brian wants to put the guardrails on for people who are maybe nervous when they have to improvise a lot. I am the kind of guy who would throw the kid that can't swim into the swimming pool, and I would say, don't do it. Try to run the game as written without any kind of extra stuff, and I think you will be rewarded.
The book is really good at giving you tools without it being obvious how useful the tools really are. I was inspired by some of Chris's blog posts, the way that he applies the different tables. For example, he has one where he's creating a location for a seer, so a sanctum, and he just rolls some random stuff and he shows everything he uses is already in the book. And he just shows how you can use the spark tables, you can use the images, you can use the suggestions that are written at the bottom of the page. And use them in ways you wouldn't initially expect if you just read over once. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Like spark tables spark your imagination. They are not really descriptive. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. The first time I read a spark table, I'm like, this is trash. There's nothing here. And then I actually used them and I'm like, this is amazing. You can do so much cool stuff with this.
And obviously, Brian, you could talk a bit more about creating a site using spark tables, because I was listening to your solo play where you, I think it's the fourth episode, where you created one and you make everything very explicit. This is the role and this is how I interpret it. How did it go for you creating a site that way?
One thing I tried to do was I was afraid that just rolling on spark tables, it would be entirely random. And every point on the hex that you build up would just be completely unrelated. So something I thought about at the start was, what's a theme or a concept that will link this together? And you have a spark table for that. You've got spark tables for drama, you've got spark tables for woe. Any kind of aspect of a story that you're interested in, there is a spark table that I think can be used to fit that. And then there's obviously the more grounded stuff like types of fauna or flora. I think spark tables are extremely helpful when you have no idea what's going to happen next. It being a relatively small number of options, and also because you're rolling 2d12 and you're getting two things to combine together rather than here's one prompt that says fire or something. The act of trying to combine two things together, I think, is the beginning of improvisation. Once you take that step and you combine two things together, you think, okay, I've combined those. How does that link to what this player character just did or what the goal they have? You know, you start making connections, which is the goal, really.
one of the things that I found in regards to those spark tables that you mentioned, the flora or the fauna one, is when I have people enter an empty hex, I just have one of my players, they roll 2d6, and I just look at those two tables, and I just open my mind almost. It's kind of like I just read the tables. If anything, you know, if there's any spark, any inspiration, you roll with that. And otherwise, you just say, you hear a bird cry above you, and you guys can carry on walking.
I'm curious, have you ever had the experience that you roll something like helpful snakes, and you put that in, and then they think this is an omen, and we're going to spend the next 20 minutes investigating the helpful snakes?
I had helpful birds. I didn't know in what way they should be helpful. So they were just essentially like a harp crew for the knights. They were just saying like, you guys are doing a good job. And they were like, carry on kind of thing. I asked one of my players afterwards, and he said, that was one of his favorite encounters, just because it was like these temperate forest. But I wanted the birds to be cool. So I made them like tropical birds, which is a little bit out of place. And they were saying, keep on, keep on. And my players loved that. So they did interact with it more than I expected them. Which again, it's like, that's, trust the system. You can come up with, some parrots that are yelling at your players, and your players, they lean into it and they roll with it. That was one of the first one shots I did, and my players reacted that way. And I was surprised still, because I was still like working with the system, coming from a D&D background. I wasn't used to that kind of improvisation. So it was a very pleasant surprise for me. Yeah.
Let's maybe finish the empty map argument. There's also, where's the treasure? What about monsters? How do you deal with that?
I think a big part of that, and I'm being influenced a little bit here by the questions I read on the Discord, is I think usually the people who are asking questions are people who intend to run the game. And often they're influenced by their group's motivations. So they've been playing with a group who is motivated by, for example, treasure. And they have the belief, and I don't know their group, maybe it's 100% true, that this group requires treasure to play a role-playing game. This is one of the key reasons that they sit down at the table and engage with the system. Again, I come back to that idea of trusting the system, and a big part of the motivation here, and it might seem simplistic, is the idea of the oath. So you have this oath that is, seek the myths, protect the realm, honor the seers, not in that order, but I don't remember the correct order. There's three sides to it. Those three sides are sometimes in conflict with each other. You can have a seer who tells you to do something that is putting the realm at risk, potentially, or you could have a choice to make between something that is good for the realm and or focusing on a myth that no one appreciates the significance of, except your knights appreciate that it's important. It can kind of unfold out into something very complex and give complex motivations to player characters. And I think it's worth exploring that. That said, obviously there's exceptions to it, and maybe some people want to find the magic item that helps with this or that. And it is a very different type of game if you're used to acquiring a lot of stuff and acquiring a lot of powers.
So maybe we shouldn't trust the system in that case, because we cannot assume that the players come with the same kind of mindset into the game. So what I like to do is, when I run a one-shot, to have the concept of the game be super-duper obvious, and also the tone. So that if you are a D&D murder hobo, and there's nothing wrong with that, and you bring that mindset to the game, you will have less fun. But if the referee sets the record straight and says, you are a knight, people will respect you, there's a certain honor expected from you, there's a certain motivation that you have, which is become renowned, you want to have 12 glory at the end of the one shot, not at the end of the one shot, but you know what I mean. When players embrace that kind of, I'm not a freebooter, I am a knight, then the question of money and treasures will probably disappear, and they will have more fun.
I do agree. I think that I've had at least twice where my players sat down and they saw that their armor score was quite low. And their immediate question was, how do I get more armor? You know, you can kind of give them suggestions. Maybe at the holding they have something, maybe you'll find something. But then after playing for about half an hour, maybe 45 minutes, they totally forgot about that treasure as a goal because they were more invested in what was actually happening with the myths and with the strange realm. So I think once you really get into the theme or the vibe, I think, at least my experience, is that the search for stats boosting treasure kind of lessens to a certain degree.
One thing I'd like to point out, if people are listening to this who have no experience with the game, it might sound like we're saying that there is some types of content that are absent from the game. But I think there are, so there are magical items, for example. You can flick through the book and you can find things on various pages in different contexts that are magical items. But I think more than that, the game gives you tools. It gives you tools to create content. And it gives you so much content at the beginning that you won't need to do that for quite a while. But by the time you want to introduce something into it, you want to create something original, you have seen how the pieces fit together very clearly. Like, you've seen that a myth can just be one page. It can be a few relatively simple prompts and maybe a couple of character blocks. And with that, you can get a session or multiple sessions of content. I think it teaches you how to put things together. And I think if you're put off by the idea that this doesn't have a bestiary, you'll quickly realize that you could write a bestiary and it would not be difficult to do so, just using what you learn from playing the game.
So with magical items, you do refer to the prompts in the on the bottom of the page. And with monsters, you also refer to these prompts. Or would you say you would make an item based on spark tables, for example, or, you know, freely improvising based on the vibe of the game?
I have a concept for an upcoming blog post. No idea if it'll ever see the light of day, where I make 72 magic items that are all related to the myths. And I was inspired to do this because I played through the Wyvern, which has poison. The antidote to the poison is fresh milk. I'd love to give one of my knights a flask of milk that like replenishes every hour or so, and that they pick it up and it's like, yeah, I don't want milk. Why do I have this? And then later on in the myth, it becomes important. So I thought it'd be really cool to do something like that. So who knows, maybe in the future.
Yeah, just the thought, and this is, again, expanding the topic a little bit. But for people who are coming into this game and it's maybe their first game in this ecosystem, or like OSR, NSR, there are a lot of games that have similar moving parts. Like, you can go to a cairn list of relics, and I think you'll get a lot of things that are thematically appropriate and don't have complex rules around them. It's something like a fishing rod that will always catch a fish, and you have to bury it in dirt under a full moon to recharge its power or something. And you don't need to know stats for that. You just, that's an object that makes sense, and you put it into your game and you're ready to go. Mythic Bastion is completely self-contained. You have everything you need. But if you want to go beyond it, there is a whole, I think ecosystem is the best word, of blogs and related games or descended games or sibling games, all sorts of things that can expand what's available to you.
There is a pretty famous OSR blog post that I can't reference now by name, but I will put it in the show notes. And that is Just Use a Bear, which is, if you need stats, just use the stats of the bear and give them some kind of special attack. Because the special attack is the interesting part, not the stat.
Yeah. This is a digression, but I do think that people get caught up in the idea of when you roll a d6, the average outcome is like 3.5. And people think that's very important. It's three, you know, I roll this and I get 3.5. In reality, the number of times you roll during a game is so low that the statistical averages are probably less important than you think. So whether you're fighting a bear with vigor 11 or a troll with vigor 12, it's probably not going to make much of a difference at the table, you know? And the players don't see that. Well, my players don't see the stats, so they wouldn't know anyway.
I think this is maybe a good point to bring in the other anxiety that people have, and that resolves around combat. It is either way too easy to use the gambits to do all the funky stuff, or even riding a horse is a really dangerous activity where people can fall off the horse and take 6 damage or d6 damage. What is your experience?
I've had probably the opposite, where, although admittedly I've played a lot of one-shots, but I find that I have been able to put up a decent threat with almost every combat, where it's not leaning towards a TPK, but the chance that I take out a squire or a knight is usually, like, if not like 100% present, it's looming. The blog post that I did quite recently, I had the Inferno, which is essentially, spoiler alert, a red dragon. And I just attacked one of the knights and I rolled so incredibly high where it's like, your knight is dead. And there were 4 knights who were doing, up until that point, pretty decently. So I've had more of those moments in my games than the enemy just gets absolutely curbstomped. So maybe if you do like a long-term campaign and they accumulate, maybe the knights with bad stats gets killed and it's only the good ones that remain, that it's easier. I'm not at the point yet where I'm worried about combat.
I have mostly played with one group. We've been playing a game for about 1.5 years, and we have been through several occasions where we would go multiple sessions without any combat. So I would say that our game is not focused on combat. But whenever it has happened, I have found it very tense, and the players have found it very tense. And this is more like a story game instinct, but I'm a fan of the players and the characters. I don't particularly want the characters to die, but I'm finding it comes very close. And I'm not pulling my punches, but we've had one character death, and there's another character who I don't understand how he's still alive, because his stats weren't great. And he has just kind of pulled through on 1 or 2 vigor several times. There was one fight that comes to mind that was maybe a little bit anticlimactic. So there was, when you read people coming from other games and they're using language like boss fight, which is not the way I think about Mythic Bastion Land. So there was something, we got to a point where there was something like a boss fight, although I would say it was more like a confrontation with an interesting character. And they overcame that character relatively easily. And it felt, in the moment, to me, like an anticlimax. But the subsequent scene was extremely dramatic. So they overpowered this guy because the system doesn't necessarily lead to death. It's more likely that you will incapacitate someone. So they essentially had a prisoner.
Mm.
And they had to decide what to do with this prisoner, and they decided that he should be executed. And they executed him in the forest, and it was a dark scene, and I loved it. I thought it was great. And, you know, I could have had him throwing fireballs at people, and everyone's, you know, using all their abilities to bounce things away, but I think that the outcome that we got was a successful session that everyone enjoyed, so.
I must say, the scene that it led into does sound really cool.
I was shocked. Every now and then, I mean, I've never successfully predicted anything these players do, but I kind of think, okay, they're leaning into this honorable knight thing. But in fairness, they had some reason to believe this guy should have his head chopped off in the forest, so they did that.
Now, one of the things that I like to do is take what my players do and have that change the world. So would you then have that forest hex where this person has been slaughtered? Would you then change that the green on the ground has gone black or something like that?
I like that idea. And I can see that fitting into many games. I think I'm running this game in a less fairy tale style.
That is a hot take right there.
I was going to say, it's on the packaging, the game's mythic.
I really enjoy the stuff that happens in the holdings, the relationships between different holdings, the politics. The myths obviously arise and crazy stuff happens. And then people get back to their day jobs and they're trying to set up a new trade route or something.
I find that really, really interesting because I try the same thing. And we're still on the topic of trust the system, because introducing these kind of mundane elements are also part of realm creation, at least if you have read the blog post where Chris suggests that you at least determine the relationship between the rulers of the 4 holdings that you normally have. I was anxious in the beginning that the mundane stuff would kind of clash with the mythic stuff and would kind of seep the fairy tale vibes out of the game. But I have found that it actually works together really well, and it makes the world kind of bigger than the players. And some of my players are almost more interested in the political intrigue than in the myths. And I think the way that a lot of myths influence rulers, the Eye, for example, one of the first 12 myths, the acolytes of the Eye want to tear down a wall of a dwelling. The Eye is going to kill a seer. That is all stuff that has political implication. The ruler cannot be happy about that. How is it in your game, William, with the mundane stuff? Do you lean into that, or do you try to focus on the mythical vibes?
I've tried to create a distinction where the holdings are somewhat normal and safe, and out in the world is where the weird stuff happens. But I can't help the temptation of putting crazy people in the streets yelling out about the Eye is a good example. In their dreams, they have seen a face in the earth and the Eyes were peering at them. That's a perfect way, as almost like a before the first omen, have like a over 0.1, I guess, yeah. So I've done that on a few occasions, and because I play a lot of one-shots, I've kind of had to reel that in because the players get really interested with the crazy person in the streets yelling out about doom and gloom.
Another anxiety that I sometimes read is, how do I resolve a myth, like, for example, the wall? How do I deal with the omens of the wall? How do I resolve the, for example, the river? So, William, isn't it strange that there is a river that they encounter because they encounter the omen, but they are in the desert, let's say?
I mean, is it strange? Yes, but that's part of the game, isn't it? I would say that at least half of your omens have to be strange, or else you're not playing the game right.
Lean into the fairy tale logic that ascends time and space is what your advice would be.
Yeah. I read a lot of games, and I've learned that you only really understand a game when you play it. You can read all the rules, you can have a sense of what they're attempting to do, but when you see people engage with it and you're interacting at the table, you see a different side to it. So I think one of the things that can happen with Mythic Bastionland, and with any game really, and I do this as well, I'm not trying to talk down to people. You look at a game and you think, this is like something I've already played. It's more like a setting book, okay? So this is King Arthur style knights riding around and, you know, having sword fights. But there are pieces of the game that actually are doing something quite different than you might expect. And the way the myths are so strange is a central part of that. And I think it links back to something we were talking about earlier, that some players may come to a game wanting a progression of collecting more magic items, collecting more powers. But when you start to find yourself in a world that doesn't make sense, where every time you leave the holding, something completely crazy happens, the idea of building up powers probably is less motivating, because at any moment you could be turned into a lizard or something, and you have no control over it. You're not powerless. I mean, obviously, you can have some agency. You have a lot of agency in this world. But becoming a stronger tank doesn't mean that you will be able to deal with what you face here. So I think the weirdness of the myths and letting them play out as best you can in the spirit that they're written is creating a different game experience than you might initially expect you're going to play.
Do you guys do like a typical transition from, you know, now they're in the mundane world, and the classic is there's a strange mist rising and now you look around and all of a sudden there's this river? Or is that always different depending on the omen?
I don't lean in too much the idea of you've stepped outside of the real world into the dream world. As much as I can, I just say, this thing is here now. But many of the omens, I don't want to overstate the weirdness, many of the omens are something like you find two bodies and it looks like they killed each other. And then there's some evidence around of how this links to something else. So they're not always too mysterious. They're not always too much of a jump to link to a mundane journey.
Is that something you mention before you start, let's say, a one-shot or when you started your campaign? That I can imagine coming to the game with an OSR mindset of an encounter is something to overcome, is like an obstacle or a puzzle or something to interact with strategically. But almost all the first omens of a myth seems to be more like something that is happening.
I've essentially done two one-shots, one which became a campaign and one which was with inexperienced players. And for the people who had not really played many RPGs before, I didn't even talk about myths and omens. I just said, I gave them a reason why they needed to travel and said, strange things can happen on journeys. Something along those lines. And that's as much as I gave them.
For me, it's kind of similar. But I think one thing that this game helps you with is as soon as you give your players their character sheets and they have a rose steed and you look at them and say, what does that mean? And they have to then come up with how their steed is linked to a rose. I think they know the strangeness of the game. And like the abilities are often very unusual things where that sets them up for the strangeness that's about to happen.
And then lastly, how do you resolve the river? The river will flood a hex. The knights stand there and see maybe people drowning or help prevent people from drowning. Is that a resolution? Will they get the glory?
I think the best way to resolve the river is describe what happens on the last omen and then look at your players and ask them if they want to do anything else in regards to the river or if they feel that it is resolved in this way. And I think players a lot of the time will come up with something. Maybe we should help the people, or maybe we should try and divert the river or something like that. And I think that helps keep the players engaged, because if they don't care about the river, they're just going to carry on. They're going to go back to the holding for the drama. But if someone lived in that hex that they thought was a cool dude, they might say, this isn't resolved until we find that dude and help him out.
Do you see possibilities for the river to be resolved before the sixth omen?
I had this discussion with someone as well, where they asked if they could avoid it from happening. And I think the way that makes most sense to me is that it's kind of dependent on the seer you talk to. If you speak to a seer who wants the place to be flooded, they'll be like, no, bro, you got to let this happen. But if your seer is like, hey, this is a bad thing, maybe, like, and then you get even more strange. Maybe they'll say there's a hex that already has some of the river in it. Find goat's milk that is harvested at daybreak and pour drops of this mixed with wine into the river. And you can come up with like weird stuff like that. And by the end of the day, the river has dried up. And then, you know, that's a way to resolve it as well, where you kind of like, it doesn't have to be super difficult, I don't think, because again, as you're moving around, omens are going to be triggering. But you lean into like the vibe and the strange of the game. And I think that's still a way that's like rewarding for players.
I enjoy when my group theorize about the myths. They'll encounter a couple of omens and then they'll start to speculate about what they can do. They, for whatever reason, well, maybe I know the reason, they don't travel to see seers very often. Maybe because seers are so weird and sometimes not helpful. So they often come up with a solution. And then it becomes a question for the referee to decide how much agency do you give them? Do you make this, you know, complete the couple of tasks they've sort of invented for themselves and it'll work, or add some complexity to it, or make it a wild goose chase and it actually won't help? I'd be inclined towards give the players something when they exercise that creativity. And they, you know, if they say the river is linked to the change of the seasons and we need to, at the festival that's at the end of the season, something will happen that will help us. I don't know what. But when they start to come up with ideas, I think that's when you improvise with what's in the myth to combine it into something more interesting.
I think I agree with that, where it's like, if your players understand the mythical nature and the weirdness of the game, they'll give you little tidbits that you can then pull on and make it kind of like lean into it. Yeah, exactly like you say, players will often give you little things like maybe this, maybe that. And if you pay attention and grab onto that and like really lean into it, you can also get some really cool results.
It's also worth pointing out that there are knights who have powers to affect reality in quite profound ways. So there is the Gazer Knight, I believe, who can declare that something that happened was a vision. It didn't really happen. So you could come to the end of the river and the Gazer Knight could say, I just had a vision of a flood, but fortunately it did not come to pass. And I think that's probably a bit of a, it's something to manage at your table, to decide amongst yourselves the degree to which you want that to influence events. I am happy to just kind of go with the flow. I can understand some people, and I've seen this as well in the Discord, people being a bit fearful of seeing the knight's abilities and thinking, this is overpowered. This guy's gonna, you know, why would he not just always stand on one leg and then no one can defeat him or whatever the power is? And I think it's about the spirit of the game to some degree. Some people will come to that and appreciate that they have this power and use it in a way that creates enjoyment for everyone at the table. And those are the type of people you should play games with, as opposed to someone who's just, I don't know, trying to beat the system somehow.
There are other ways that you can make the story interesting. There's this seer that is upset that the river didn't come to fruition because someone deemed it a vision. And now a seer that was hoping that the river would happen is disappointed. And you can have that change the world as well. Maybe that seer had a company of knights that worked for them, or that are on good terms. And now this is not exactly an enemy immediately, but maybe they're a little bit unfriendly towards your company. So even when someone like nips a myth in the bud and stops the whole thing from unraveling because they have an ability, I still think there are ways that you can like lean into that and create something that they can respond to that's kind of dramatic and kind of like make it a bit mythic as well.
The book is actually full of really good refereeing advice, and there is mentioned that you should honor decisions that players made and also show the impact to advanced situations that haven't been resolved and so forth. So the world is dynamic, and only because the hex is now a lake, it doesn't mean that the realm won't keep on changing.
One more thing about myths is when you read them in the book, you can have the impression that what happens is you travel to a part of the realm, you step through the omens for a specific myth, and somehow it ends. Either you reach the end of the myth or you resolve it before you reach the end. And in reality, you travel around and you're seeing different myths being triggered because it's random. And there's an interaction between them because you may not know how they are related to each other. Are they part of the same myth or are they something different? I would be inclined to not even explain the mechanic unless the players are very interested in knowing how it works. And also there's other things happening in the realm. There's the consequences of the last myth you resolved. There's the politics of the realm. There's the dynamics in the company. Maybe the knights are not getting along so well. Who knows? So I think when you read it, you just look at it on paper, you think it's almost like a board game where you travel around the map to a particular location and resolve something, you tick it off, and then you move to the next location. And in reality, everything is messy and there's loose threads everywhere. And you'll very quickly build up something quite complex, even just in a few sessions, and you'll find that the players want to go to this place. And I've had multiple occasions where the first myth of the Citadel, for example, this giant crooked tower that no one had ever seen before, is there before them. And they just said, we don't have time for this. And they rode on because they were dealing with a bunch of other things. And there was an impact to that. I mean, later on, you know, the Citadel went a little bit unchecked and had maybe a bigger impact. But I think that's a sign of a really exciting game, that something incredibly sticky and interesting can happen, and it's still less interesting than what you're already doing. You know, you just keep riding because you have somewhere else to be.
All right, so we have talked about myths, we have talked about omens, we have talked a little bit about combat and virtues, not a lot. And I would like to use the opportunity to ask you guys how you would handle a certain situation.
Is this a situation from a game or when you've invented?
This is a situation from a game that happened a couple of months ago. It happened in a Play by Post. The way I do it, I have live action sessions and Play by Post sessions alternating. In a Play by Post session, the knights had taken a prisoner. The prisoner has super duper important information. Life and death, war and peace. It can't get bigger than that. and the players decided to threaten him with the justice of the blade. Either tell us the secret or you will be killed. It feels something is at stake. There is a danger. There's a clear danger. It's an important decision that the referee can't just, you know, wing or improvise. There's a role, or is there?
The first thing that comes to mind is that it's way more dramatic for the person being threatened to essentially just like spit in the knight's face, because the knights, if they kill their prisoner, there is zero chance that they get the information. And essentially, I think calling their bluff would be way more dramatic, because if they then kill the prisoner, they have to live with the consequences of that action, which is probably going to be pretty severe. Or they'd have to show that they're backing down and finding an alternative to get this person to talk.
Okay, so what I hear is there is no role. There's GM fiat or referee fiat, and you would say they don't break.
I think that's way more dramatic, yeah.
Brian?
Him dying and nothing being revealed is the less interesting outcome than they get some information. If you'll indulge me, I'd like to roll on a spark table to give my full answer.
But that means in the real game, you would also roll on the spark table, right?
If I didn't already know what this guy's desire was, I would roll a desire and he would either tell them, here's the information, and frame it in some way where he gets closer to getting his desire, or he would lie to them, again, trying to get out of the situation and get to what he's trying to do. But I think, yeah, I think I'd be inclined to give up the information rather than saying you do a spirit roll and if you succeed, then you scare him enough to win.
That was my instinct, which is completely wrong. Obviously, because it was a play by post, I had the luxury of having the time to just ask people on the Discord. And Yochai Gal was friendly enough to chime in. And he said, if you want to roll, and I wanted to roll, I didn't want the GM fiat of, well, I rolled the personality. He is pretty loyal. He will never tell the secret. He's loyal to his fellow mercenaries. Maybe my worry was, what is a danger? A danger is that something terrible happens in the future. Am I even allowed as the referee to call that a danger? Because if we go to the action procedure, we have to look at the fact, is there a danger? And if the save fails, then the danger comes to pass. But because the danger is in the future, that doesn't really apply. And Yochai said, you have to look at who is at most at danger in that situation. And the person most in danger in that situation was the mercenary. So I rolled a save for them. Mm-hmm. Now comes the crazy part at the end. They didn't make the roll. They failed their save. What am I supposed to do now? The save is so that the danger doesn't come to pass. What is the danger? The knights kill him. Or is the danger that he will spill the beans?
Well, I mean, what's he rolling? He's rolling like a spirit save. The natural way to interpret that for me is he's trying to keep his resolve and hold true to his loyalty. And if he fails, he cracks and spills the beans.
And that is how I interpreted the situation. He told them the location of the warband, and that became the next session where I made a site, maybe a future topic.
Were you happy with that decision afterwards, or would you run it differently if it happened again?
I was happy with the decision in both cases, even if he had made the save. And, you know, now I have to see, are they so cold-blooded to kill, you know, the person that is at their mercy?
Maybe this is Dante GM style, but for me, that is way more interesting to see if they do indeed, in cold blood, kill this person.
That is an interesting, like, you both said the same thing. What is the most interesting thing that is supposed to happen? And for me, that is the utmost horror. I don't want to have any part in that decision. I want the dice to decide what is going to happen, not me making a judgment call. What would be interesting for the story? I am, you know, I play story games, but when I play Mythic Bastionland, I am in the OSR mindset.
I think I might be on the borderline between OSR and story games when I'm playing, and it's a vague border.
I find it way more interesting to present my players with the most dramatic choice and have them choose. I prefer that over a dice roll where possible. So if I make clear to them you guys can kill this guy and then he's not telling you anything. You're not getting that secret. Up until now, he's just spat on your shoes. To me, it's dramatic in the sense that the ball is now in their court. The stakes have been laid out and they now have to make a decision.
Emergent storytelling to me means I want to be surprised. I don't want to make a decision and then put the ball in the court of the players. I want to be surprised about what is about to happen. Will he break? Won't he break? That is where, you know, the people around the table hold their breath and see where the dice land. And then I roll with it. All right, listeners, we have talked about the myths. We have talked about the omens, why the map is maybe less empty than you might have thought in the beginning. I hope you enjoyed this episode. This has been the Smiling Fox Mythic Bastion Land podcast, and I hope to speak to you guys soon.
Goodbye.